This is We Only Want the Earth, an exploration of how contemporary composers in Ireland are responding to the climate and biodiversity crisis through their work.
Words like sustainability, phrases like climate change, they lose their power. They become marketable. Music is amongst the most powerful things we have in the world to convey sentiment and emotion.
I feel like I could never say I was a climate change composer because I'm writing about the world we live in, and that happens to be an aspect of it.
For me, because music has to exist in the world, it makes sense that it should engage with it actively instead of just by accident.
I would say because of its severity on a global scale in just everyday life at the moment, it seeped in out of kind of osmosis.
The voices there of musicologist Stephen Graham and composers Jennifer Walsh, Sebastian Adams and Aina Brennan. I'm Jonathan Grimes, and in this series I've taken my bike on the road to chat with composers across Ireland to find if music can be a climate storyteller and help us shape solutions for a better future for all. In our first episode, we heard how recording the sound of nature inspires the world of Karen Power, Robert Coleman and Natalia Bayliss. In this episode, we're digging deeper and seeing if music can help us respond to the crisis. Can music play a more direct role in communicating climate breakdown and promoting positive action? Here's composer Ian Wilson.
We like to listen to music because it affects how we feel, our mood. And, you know, once you try and do more with that, and it's not opera and it's not telling a story, or it's telling a different kind of story, it's very tricky. I think it's very tricky to try and hope that you'll change somebody's point of view about how they're living through a piece of music. I think that's very difficult.
You know, music is a delivery system that brings together our experience as individuals with the greater experience around us. When we talk about music and the climate emergency, inevitably we think about it in terms of our silos that we operate in.
Stephen Graham there. He lectures in music at Goldsmiths College, London.
So if we're coming from a classical music perspective, we might think about really concrete things like the impact of orchestras touring and the fact that we have a culture where big international ensembles travel around the world, often in ways that are not sustainable in any sense, or not even organized in a way that's cohesive. So they'll do one trip and then they'll come back and then they'll do another trip to somewhere near the first trip. So it doesn't really align with the kinds of sustainable development goals that we have.
Stephen Graham. The need to travel to produce work is also something that concerns composer Jennifer Walsh.
Like all musicians now, we're completely torn by the fact that if we don't get to travel, we don't get to do music in the way that music is best done, which is that people are exposed to different types of music by different people live in performance. It's not just over your headphones. And I feel very conflicted, as I know many, many musicians do, because it feels like we know the car crash is happening, but it's happening in such slow motion that we're still in the car. So I feel utterly confused, and I try to process some of that emotion through my work.
Jennifer Walsh. You're listening to Jennifer's piece, Mars One, about two women astronauts setting off to explore the red planet. But more on that later. This dilemma over the role of composers in the climate crisis came up again and again in my chats with them. But then, given the existential challenge we're all facing, it's no surprise artists are struggling to find answers.
The climate challenge has been framed as one that is about technologies. You know, we're using the wrong fuels, the wrong cars, electricity comes from the wrong sources, or we're eating the wrong things. But it's clearly not just technology when we have all those solutions already.
That's Hannah Daly, climate scientist at University College Cork and our scientific advisor on this series.
It's a question of why are we opposing those solutions? And that's because many different things. There's the status quo is very powerful in our minds, in our habits, in our infrastructure, in our institutions. And change is hard, even when change is for the better. There's vested interests who want to keep the status quo. In many ways, we're all part of the vested interests. We're all benefiting a lot from the status quo. And so we have to see this as much as a cultural, as a political, as a societal challenge, as much as a technical and an economic one.
Where do you think musicians and composers can play a role in communicating all this change?
A lot of the solutions can be used to bring about a better world, more livable cities, restored nature, ecosystems, cleaner air, more time for each other if we kind of slow down a bit. People experience that change quite negatively. The people don't necessarily want to change. They feel threatened by a change. And I think unless we can actually have the vision for what a future looks like that we can work towards, it's very difficult to convince people of where we want to go. And that's where arts and culture and media has a big role to play. But this is enormously difficult to communicate because in our human history, we've never faced such a challenge. Like, unlike with war or with famine, that we have this deep history that we know we don't want to avoid, and we have these global institutions that avoiding these things. We don't have that for climate change because we haven't faced this problem before.
Just into a wooded section with a little pathway. It's always nice to ride on some of these little sections because we're safely away from traffic. It's a crisp February morning and I'm in Massey's estate, a woodland at the foot of the Dublin Mountains where composer and saxophonist Nick Roth is leading a walk with children from Gaelscoil na Fuinseoga. Little Woodland Heights is a programme devised by Nick to engage children in nature through music. Each child selects a tree that will become part of the final music piece they create.
The branch and the trunk architecture of the tree, we're going to turn into a rhythmic clave. So basically when the tree kind of splits, the beat splits, so this tree would start like doof, doof, tack, tack. Mm-hmm. And then the melody is coming from the pattern of the leaves, which you can see here is in an opposite pairing, which is called the phylotaxic pattern, and that's going to give us a kind of a sung melody. And then the third aspect is the field recording, which we're making, which we're going to amplify in performance.
For Nick Roth, trees are a big part of his life and his creativity. He grew up surrounded by woods.
So in our back garden was primary old growth forest, and we had amazing wildlife there, deers and badgers and foxes, and it was an incredibly privileged place to grow up. when I was a kid, me and my brothers would just come home from school, run out into the garden, straight up a tree, we'd have our den. And I formed very close bonds with trees at that time. I could say that some of my best friends were trees.
Over a decade ago, his family had to sell their home, but it was the loss of the forest that had the most impact on him.
We, as a family, kind of lost all of our money and savings, and my dad lost his business, and we lost the house, and it was sold to developers who destroyed everything and cut the forest down. It was a very traumatic time for the family, and really my greatest trauma was of losing the forest. A house is just a house, but a primary forest like that takes 1,000 years to reach maturity. And apart from that, it was a place that I could close my eyes and just be in at any moment, and still can, because of those really formative childhood years.
That trauma of seeing the forest cut down resulted in a piece for string orchestra named after the house he used to live in, Woodland Heights. It's based on the story of a forest across 700 years.
It was a really traumatic time, but out of that trauma, the pieces were birthed, and they wouldn't have had that kind of energy, and I wouldn't have given so much time to it if it wasn't a result of trying to deal with that trauma. So I decided to use that as an opportunity to write a piece about forests in general. And so the forest that was mapped out through the evolution of the music, that was all modeled on that particular forest. The orchestra to engage with the subject itself, and at a certain point in the composition I realized that I needed the soloist to actually plant a tree in the ground, and so it's scored as Si piante un albero, now plant a tree, and the soloist himself was, or herself was, the wild apple, which increased the biodiversity of the forest. And what I was trying to show with the piece is that over time the biodiversity of a forest will tend to increase. This is where the leaves are going to be, the buds. But we might be able to find a...
In Little Woodland Heights, which grew out of that string orchestra piece, the children also get to plant a tree as part of their work. By participating in the programme, they become the composers, listeners and performers of the piece, something that's central to Nick's philosophy of music.
One of the things that I've realized through studying lots of different diverse fields like water and bird flocking and astrophysics and genetics and so on, is that it's only really where the composer, the listener and the performer are embodied in the same person that you get this real transmission of knowledge. And so I wanted Little Woodland Heights to bring in the children as composers themselves. I wanted them to have ownership over the piece. And I wanted that process of discovery to be encoded in the actual score itself, so that at the end of it, the children would have their own piece. They're also learning to read rhythmic notation, and they're learning to read stave notation. And what you then learn when you start to gather these materials and you put all of the different pieces together from each child is that they understand that the biodiversity of composition is dictated by the trees that they've chosen. If all of the children choose the beech tree, they all have pretty much the same rhythm and pretty much the same melody. That idea that the compositional process itself is an analog of the kinds of principles and the kinds of ways that these living seeds can be created by is really essential. What we're doing in composition and in all of the arts generally is providing a mirror. Yesterday, actually, I finished Bernie Krause's book, who's one of the world's kind of leading field recordists and has recorded thousands of hours for 60 years. And a lot of the places that he's recorded, he's been able to go back to 20 years later or 30 years later. And
walking through the woods with Nick and the children illustrated how music can help children become more aware of their natural environment and their place within it.
A lot of his work has been on showing the effect of noise.
Seeing how the children explored the forest, each selecting a tree, gave me hope for the future. But that hope began to evaporate as we walked out of the forest.
Whoa. They're literally just cutting it down with a massive... That's the reality of foresting in Ireland. That noise. It's weird though, all of these, this tree felling we hear in the background is National Broadband Ireland. For the cables, there's definitely a pretty clear metaphor going on in here.
For the quick is
And for me now, the idea of cutting down any tree at all for any reason is completely insane. Like I just think it's murder. Why would you do that? And if you're planting a tree, you have to consider how big it's going to grow and what's above it and what's near it, or you don't plant it in that area. Because I feel that kind of pain because I'm losing friends, you know? And if you don't grow up in that environment, then you don't feel that sense of loss. You don't feel that trauma when it's happening, and you get anesthetized to the question. You don't feel the urgency of it and the immediacy of it.
Depending on where you cycle, what part of the country, you always physically begin to understand the landscape, how the land is used or maintained.
Nick Roth's work is an illustration of one way a composer can work within a community and inspire change. But the climate crisis is also impacting on how composers are responding to forms like opera.
I think because of its prevalency at the moment, it's very hard to turn a blind eye to it. And I think it's important not to necessarily, if you have a way that you think you can approach it in maybe a different or engaging way.
That's Aina Brennan. She was born and raised in Belgium, but she's come back to make Ireland home. When you're trying to reflect the climate crisis in your music, is it overwhelming?
it's an overwhelming subject matter in that we're seeing a very tangible cause and effect now. So I think aside from it being something that's been of concern for quite a long time, it's affecting people's daily lives. And I think approaching that as a composer, you can either go personal, you know, if it's something that's happened to you directly, you can engage with it that way. But also you can take a step back and look at the bigger picture and kind of look at it as a global phenomenon.
Aina studied at Trinity College Dublin with composers Evangelia Ragacki and Donica Dennehy. It is poisoned. She's working on a new opera based on climate change, Hold Your Breath. An element of this has formed a shorter operatic work, Breath Work, with Irish National Opera and was performed as part of the Dublin Theatre Festival in 2023. It is poisoned. We poisoned the venomous. Did we do this? Did we? Guilt has no positive outcome.
Hold Your Breath is a collaborative contemporary opera project run by the Bregenzer Festspiele, based in Bregenz in Austria. And it's a collaborative project between a visual artist, a composer and a director. I'm taking care of the composition side of things. And then we have Hugo Canoilas, who is a Portuguese visual artist. And then Sir David Pountney, he is the director for the project and also he is the librettist.
It was Aina's 2020 piece, Rupture, created during the pandemic, that led to this commission. She says the idea of the global climate crisis as a theme grew organically within the group. The warmth of the light, it drapes itself around my skin.
I feel it. So, aside from the global conversation about climate change, we were getting to grips with how to navigate what we were allowed to do and what we weren't allowed to do within the pandemic and the parameters of meeting each other, because we were all living in three different countries. So many of those variables all played into what we ended up talking about within the work. On a personal level, we were talking about how to be able to create work in a way that doesn't put each other in harm's way, or trying to figure out what matters. How do we write something that's going to matter to people? And because we wanted to write something that would matter to people in 2024, I think the abstract nature of the work would be quite important, because if we were too literal, it could be dated or it could just be wrong. I definitely always write with performance in mind. I think very much about the audience's experience as I push through. And in that regard, I think we wanted to be as inclusive as possible. We're all accountable. There's a responsibility that we all have. But I think trying to get people to see an overarching cause was maybe slightly more effective for me anyway. So I wanted to use David's text to make us think about this philosophically and look at climate change as something that we understand but don't understand, and what are its repercussions to us but also to the whole planet, to nature, so that it's not all about cause and effect in a very rational sense. And I think, again, having the audience involved in that so that we're all thinking about these big questions is the most important part. We're kind of looking at it in its raw material. We're like, what is happening? Why is it happening? What does it mean? Without the blaming.
Aina's non-judgmental approach to climate breakdown in her opera makes me think about how we're all part of a system creating it. And being part of the system that's fueling global warming makes it difficult for us to transform from within. But can music reflect these tensions, or is it separate from politics? Here's Sebastian Adams.
People have this idea that it's separate from the world. It doesn't have to be political. It doesn't have to be about anything because it's just sound. And this is a very prevalent idea, especially in classical music, where you even have conversations about, you know, well, we shouldn't care what the musicians wear. As if even the visual aspect of a performance is not relevant because only sound is important. But the reality is you have musicians on stage, you have bodies. They're moving, the way they move actually affects psychoacoustically the way you hear the music. But also you're probably in a place which is funded by somebody with a lot of money, a state. So straight away there you have music is already engaging with the outside world. Even if you ignore it, if you go and you write a beautiful symphony and that's all you do, the thing is your music is still existing in this world where it's part of much wider systems. And so for me, like, because music has to exist in the world, it makes sense that it should engage with it actively instead of just by accident.
Sebastian Adams on how music engages with the world. But are there different levels to this engagement? Stephen Graham thinks so.
Probably the biggest binary when I think about the climate and music is the separation between sort of hard and soft politics. So hard politics in terms of what we do, the behaviors that we model, the way we move around the world, the way we put on gigs and so on, versus the soft stuff of what are the messages, what are the feelings we're conveying through our work. I suppose we have to think about those two things in slightly different terms because they're in some senses separate. But really, for me, if we can sort of reconcile and think about those two things in alignment, that as well can be a really powerful way to think about the true role that music can have in our lives, particularly in terms of the climate crisis, but more generally.
I certainly felt as an artist slightly backed into a corner at one point.
That's composer Karen Power. Someone who has recorded in many remote places in the world, including Antarctica.
Because clearly here I was working with these environments that are disappearing, and it's very difficult to find space for the art. If I had tried to put climate on my work, it would have just been subsumed by a political message, and I don't think it would speak. So it's taken me a while to find a way in to that, that I'm comfortable with and that I feel puts the places and the sounds and climate there where it can be heard.
I don't think we should be going around pretending that musicians and artists can change the world.
That's Sebastian Adams, a composer and viola player from Dublin.
The actual tangible impact that artists can have on like serious political issues and societal things is pretty small. And it kind of puts us in this old-fashioned position of being like heroes. I think it would be much more honest and humble to accept that we're really not that important. I mean, part of the purpose of art is for sure just to give people meaningful and beautiful experiences that they can't get any other way. And part of it is to gradually help expand the thinking of society in general. And I think this is where artists can help a bit, because we can help to push the conversations forward a little bit. Of course, it's a very small impact, but if we have a lot of artists and musicians who are all thinking that way, we can maybe collectively make quite a big impact. One of the big dangers with any kind of political art is that people don't really like being told what to think. It can feel a bit violent almost and unsubtle. If you feel like you know for sure what the artist is trying to get you to think about, it doesn't really encourage you to expand your own thinking.
So what drives you creatively, Sebastian?
I mostly compose music that's both conceptual and also experimental, in the sense that normally, quite often, I really am trying to find something out when I work on a piece, whether it's something like what sound will come out if I try this, or just what the effect of letting a particular process unfold will be.
You're listening to Sebastian Adams' Tide Quartet, that was performed as the tide was coming in on Blackrock Beach in Dublin during the Biosphere Festival in 2020.
Tide Quartet is a piece where a string quartet sit on chairs in the sea playing their instruments, and the tide comes in starting from foot depth till it reaches each player's neck, and then each player wades out of the sea when it's up to their neck. I've quite often just described that piece to people, and I can see in their eyes that they understand the piece, you know, and that they've experienced something just by hearing that that piece exists. It's so much more about the poetic idea of the fact that the string quartet played in the water till it came up to their necks than it is really about hearing the music.
And is the main idea behind this work rising sea levels?
I suppose I'm very reluctant to say that it's about the rising sea levels or something. I mean, I'm not going to pretend I didn't think about that. I was much more motivated by what I thought was a beautiful idea that I wanted to try out than I was by trying to kind of make people think about that. And I felt if I wrote in the program note or when I discussed the piece that I said it's about rising sea levels, it's sort of collapsing the possibilities of the piece by making it directly this kind of, I don't know, an activist piece. And it felt for me like it didn't need to be direct.
I'm outside Unit 44 in Stonybatter, Dublin. It's a DIY music space run by Kirkos Ensemble, the new music group co-founded by Sebastian Adams in 2012. Okay, so, Kirkos's most recent work, A Beginner's Guide to Slow Travel, explores the carbon cost of music performance. This piece was commissioned by three festivals, New Music Dublin, Sound Festival Aberdeen, and Huddersfield Contemporary Music Festival, where it was premiered in 2023.
It's like a group commission. So six of us are all co-devising it. You know, the whole starting point was we're going to make a big piece about climate change. Music producers everywhere now and promoters are going to have to face this thing of like, well, it's increasingly bad press to be using the planes. It's possible that they're going to get much more expensive. It's so much better if people can avoid using them. But of course, we live on an island and so do people in the UK.
Sustainable travel raises lots of issues for composers when it comes to performance.
If people are going to start traveling to festivals in general by boat and train, it's going to take them a lot longer to get there. I mean, most performing musicians try and do as many gigs as they possibly can, which means a day where you're just traveling is potentially a lost day of income. And so festivals and musicians are going to have to work out this compromise at some point over, like, how are those days paid for? Is it like paid for directly by the festivals? Or is it that musicians account for that as part of their kind of budgeting of time and money? It draws this link between musicians trying to deal with this themselves and also the institutions and funders, you know, the fact that we're doing it specifically to go to festivals. So for me, yeah, sure, that's a more direct way of thinking about it.
Sebastian's interest in slow travel began at that Biosphere Festival in Dublin.
Because we were working outside a lot, we really tried to make pieces that didn't have a big impact on the place we were performing, either during the performance or certainly not afterwards. So we mostly did stuff that didn't need amplification, we weren't using power, we weren't imposing a stage on the natural landscape. We were actually just more melting into the landscape instead of trying to dominate it. We did crazy things that were really for show, of like pushing a piano 5 or 6 kilometers to the beach. It was more about the gesture than the actual carbon savings, really, anyway.
Four years on, Sebastian sees the work that Kirkos is doing as more direct and challenging the current system in music.
I think this is part of a big moment that a lot of artists are having, because, you know, I'm doing this in work by myself, but also it's in collaborations with different people, with Kirkos and also other groups of people. And it's like dealing a little bit with hierarchy and rethinking the role of composer and thinking, well, no, actually, let's not make pieces with a composer. Let's make pieces where it's six people all working on the same level with fluid roles. A lot of these projects are addressing power and hierarchy and organization and structures, both in the actual content of the piece that's delivered, which might be, say, involve audience interaction, giving agency to the audience in a way, or it might be just we organize it without a leader and it's trying to be six equal voices and really intentionally trying to avoid any kind of hierarchy emerging. I think these experiments, both within pieces and also with the organization of groups of artists, examining hierarchies and power structures, it feels like a fruitful way of making music or art that's kind of politically aware, because I think we need to have a lot of ideas flying around right now for how we're going to reorganize society, because I think, at least this is the way I feel, I'm like hoping for some kind of like collapse of the current power structures, but I have no idea what the best way to replace them is. And we have such a big chance of something worse coming along.
Thank you.
wrong turn. Need to turn around. And it was on a hill as well. I may think I'm doing this sustainably, but I'm relying on GPS, sat nav, all this stuff pushed down to me from the cloud with banks of servers. I guess when you think about climate, climate is everything. It's how we live our lives. That's what makes it so complicated.
A huge part of it seems to be the fact that art making is embedded in a capitalist system.
That's Jennifer Walsh.
And has no choice but to be embedded in a capitalist system. And if you privatize the trains and somebody needs to get somewhere, capitalism will make sure that they're paying the maximum that they can possibly pay to get there, which means that the arts organization are going to start to rely on cheaper forms, which are probably far worse for the environment to get the people there.
The big money energy follows.
So it's very, very tangled mess. And I don't feel I understand how we sort of start to disentangle that. Sorry, I don't have any easy answers today. Everything is grey rather than black and white, and everything is a tangled, tangled mess.
Everything is very misty, like outside.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Probably if it was yesterday when it was sunny here, I'd feel like I had the answers. Yeah,
yeah. On the internet, he doesn't really own them, but he owns them. But he owns
Jennifer's work reflects so many aspects of contemporary life, including climate change. Her piece with Matthew Slomovich, Minor Characters, was premiered at the Darmstadt Festival with Ensemble Nickel in 2023.
And there's a section where I'm singing, "We all knew, and yet we did nothing about it. You all knew, he knew, we all knew, and yet we did nothing, we did nothing." When I'm in that moment singing that at the audience and at myself, I'm not trying to blame anybody and say I'm better than you. I'm just trying to say, what the hell? I don't know. You know, this is the confusion. This is the absolute weird terror that we all live in every day.
It's a ridiculously expensive way to own a JPEG, but I like it.
I've travelled by bike on a very wet day to visit her at her home in rural Roscommon, where she divides her time between there and London.
I love it here. I walk out the front door of my house at night and I can see the Milky Way if it's clear night. And so I feel very, very connected to the planet. Not just to nature, but just to the idea that we live on a planet that's moving through space, and that I find very nourishing. We just got fibre optic cable, which has completely transformed our lives. So even though we're out in the middle of nowhere, we're connected in a way we've never been connected before.
For Jennifer, composition allows her to process and understand life in all its complexities.
It's just how I make sense of the world. You know, it's how I make sense of things that happen in my life. How I make sense of the world that I'm embedded in. And I feel lucky that I have something that I enjoy doing that I get to sort of metabolize or process. You know, whether they're personal experiences of joy or sadness, or whether they're sort of personal experiences of absolute confusion or anger or joy about how it is to be in the world.
So much of experimental music relies on digital technology, and Jennifer is profoundly curious about the role technology plays in creative art.
A lot of what you see in terms of new music and experimental music is unbelievably reliant on anywhere between 10 to 20k worth of electronics being on a table on stage in order for the show to happen in the first place. I did a show at Transmediale in Berlin. I was due to do the project with a long-term collaborator of mine, John Lidecker, also known as Wobbly. And we were talking about the fact that when John and I play together, there's just two of us. We have a bunch of broken iPads, old iPads and new iPads. And because we have all that tech on the stage, we can make a huge performance, a big, rich, layered performance that makes it sound like there's an orchestra worth of people up there, and it can last for an hour, and it could be in quadraphonic sound if we wanted. Like, we're able to go and they can pay just two people's fees and they get something sonically which 40 years ago you would need it to have 10 or 15 people on that stage. And I said, like, so already we're embedded in that system because we're all using all this technology. Mm. And using all of this technology, it's not inert, it's not neutral. They're expensive machines which had metals dug out of the earth, and they're embedded in operating systems in terms of the software that we can't extract ourselves from.
She's hopeful that AI, generative artificial intelligence, can help us find climate solutions.
You know, I was reading this morning that the Gulf Stream may stop. It could reverse and cease to function properly. So those sort of computations are being done using a load of AI. And if we get those calculations right, that could maybe help and save lives and save land and save parts of the planet.
Jennifer's fascinated by the idea of space travel and the focus tech billionaires are putting on Mars. She's composing an opera about it with writer Mark O'Connell for Irish National Opera.
Thinking about Mars means instantly you're thinking about everything we've just been talking about. You're thinking about the climate crisis. You're thinking about capitalism. You're thinking about the fact that we have tech billionaires that are all obsessed with going to space, and what does that mean for us as a species? You're thinking about inequality. You're thinking about widening gaps of income. All of that is wrapped up when we start to think about Mars. So if you're going to think about Mars, you're thinking about everything. And so I was delighted that Mark O'Connell was up for being the librettist, because his writing is just phenomenal and he thinks about the world in that way. He's thinking about these large, interconnected, social, scientific, technological phenomena. Everything that I've read so far about Mars and life in space shows you how ridiculous it is that we're here at all in the first place. The amount of tiny little turning points in history that got us to the point that we could all be alive, the chances of it are just literally astronomical that we would have been alive in the first place. We don't just live as human beings. Like, we're living here in this atmosphere within this gravitational system. So Mark and I are sort of really fascinated by this absolute quotidian stuff. Like, how do people go for a wee in space? If you can't take a shower in space, like, how do you stop stinking up the whole space station? You know, how do you eat? How do you, like, actually get water into your mouth? The more granular you go with these things and the more nerdy you get with them, the more clear it becomes to you that there's no way we're going to have people living on Mars. It's just too difficult.
Do you think music and art can play an important role in drawing attention to the fallacy of these exploits in relation to Mars, and maybe in a broader sense motivate people and communities to drive for change?
Art has the capacity to make us feel emotions and make us feel moved and give us another person's experience or step into another consciousness. And all of those things can help shift how people behave. I definitely agree with that. I'm wary of artists having to put pressure on themselves to do that. I think it's difficult to do it well. I don't mean to sound pessimistic, because I have many examples of it being done very well, but I think that it's doing that fine line between lecturing people and telling a story that's vivid.
So I've come to the end of my journey. I've cycled over 1,000 kilometres and met with composers from many different musical backgrounds. And while each of them connects with the climate crisis from a different perspective, they all share a concern and a love for our planet that flows into their music. When I reflect on this journey and those conversations, I'm struck by how music and art has the ability to give us hope and courage to face the climate emergency and maybe shape solutions. Music can't provide a pathway to an emissions-free future, but it has a subtle power to move us to understanding and even action. In my chat with him, Nick Roth framed it beautifully, that art fuels life, that love, not fear, is our motivation to change, reminding us all that we only have the earth.
For the majority of humans that live on it, and for the majority of animals and birds that are here, there's still an incredible wealth that exists, and all of the necessary ingredients to transition towards a less damaging future already are here. And anything which is done out of fear will ultimately result in failure. And the only ways that we can really create a sustainable future is to act out of love. And that love comes from an enjoyment of the world that we live in. And things like the arts and like music foster this love of expression, this love of being, this excitement of being alive, this energy that we can express through being a living being that you hear when you listen to bird song, or you listen to frog song, or you see the way that a bird flies in the sky. Every species has its own way of expressing this delight in existing. So that's what we need to tap into. And all of the arts are fuel for that kind of energy.